Well, birds do it, bees do it, even the flowers and the trees do it. But given how smart we think we are, why did it take us 14,000 years to realize plants actually do it? And that we now know plants do it, we wonder, do plants enjoy sex?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1025th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there in Monte Carlo who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Jason, we're having an exciting one here in the studio, right?
Pleasure to share the studio, sir.
Well, folks, it's true. Birds do it. Bees do it. Even the flowers and the trees do it. But given how smart we think we are, why do so many of us appear to be in the dark regarding the fact that plants actually have sex? Get this. In 1996, the Pollinarium exhibit at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., conducted a survey of its visitors to learn how well it was fulfilling its mission of teaching the public about the sexual function of plants and pollinators. Before seeing the exhibit, 70% of the visitors failed to make the connection between pollen and the sexual reproduction of plants. After seeing the exhibit, with all its bees, butterflies, and beautiful flowers, 70% of the respondents still did not make the connection between pollen and the sexual reproduction of plants. Though we live in and with all the technologies of modern times, many of us still appear to suffer from a perception problem when it comes to the sex life of plants. This reluctance to see and understand the sex life of plants dates back over 14,000 years to when we Homo sapiens began domesticating animals and planting crops. We quickly figured out the sex life of animals and used that knowledge to breed into them the traits we desired. But when it came to plants, it took us about 14,000 years to figure things out. That it took so long for us to overcome our problems with perception, and that so many of us still have perception problems, leads us to ask, do you think plants enjoy sex? Well, here to help us search for an answer for this incredibly fun problem, we have the co-authors of Flora Unveiled, The Discovery and Denial of Sex in Plants. With us we have UC Biology Research Associate Lee Tays. Lee? Good morning and welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning.
Thank you. Now, also with us, UC Professor Emeritus of Biology, Lincoln Tays. Dr. Lincoln, welcome aboard.
Hi, Michael.
Pleased to have you. So let's start a little bit about, first of all, with Lee. What does a biology research associate do?
Research and biology. My job at UCSC was mainly electron microscopy.
Ah, looking way down deep at things.
That's right.
Good. And Dr. Lincoln, you are a professor emeritus. You're a plant physiologist. What does a plant physiologist do?
Well, plant physiology is the study of plant processes, how plants grow and develop and reproduce, and at the cell and molecular level as well as at the macro level. And so that's my lab has spent most of the time studying plant hormones and how they regulate plant development.
Mm-hmm. And I suspect in your career in plant physiology, you've seen a lot of knowledge develop over the past few years with respect to plants and the genetic makeup of plants?
Absolutely. The genomics revolution is just stunning. When I was a graduate student, the idea of actually knowing the genome of any organism, let alone a plant, was just a dream. And now we have complete genomes of many plants. And practices really facilitated research and sped up progress on a lot of problems.
Well, there we go. Now, you wrote a book, Flora Unveiled, and the subtitle was pretty cool as well, The Discovery and Denial of Sex in Plants. So we always ask our guests who pays the way. Do you want to know kind of who backs the research and whatnot? Who is paying the way for this book on Flora Unveiled?
Well, the book, I should say, is still hasn't been published yet. It's in the works. Oxford University Press will be publishing it in about a year. And, of course, this has been a project long in development. We've been working on this book about 20 years. So no one has been paying for it other than ourselves.
Good. Okay,
up until
that's,
now.
That's hugely significant, because then we can expect some degree of Lee and Lincoln Tays in the book and not somebody else. And that's why we always ask. So let's start a little bit with our perception problems with plants. And you tell this wonderful story about the Pollinarium at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., asking questions. What is pollen? They asked the question before people went in the Pollinarium and after they came out, and they just didn't seem to get it.
Yes, this was quite remarkable. To me, I've taught biology, throughout my career, and I always assumed that my students, at least, were learning how plants reproduce, and I assumed that it was fairly widely understood because of all the TV shows that often feature insects pollinating flowers, and so I was stunned to read the article in the paper reporting the results of this survey that you described.
And the interesting thing about that was that people who would actually go through a pollinarium are the kinds of people you would think would actually be interested to know.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think interferes with people's understanding is the concept of pollen as an allergen. Now, this is something that's always it used to be emphasized in TV commercials for decongestants, how allergies were caused by pollen, and people have learned that too well. And at the Pollinarium exhibit, right at the entrance, I noticed that they had a large micrograph of a pollen grain with a little description of how it's a cause of allergies, and a good portion of the people who viewed the exhibit came away from it learning that rather than
the good Lord put pollen on earth to give us hay fever.
Well,
right?
This is part of punishment for original sin, maybe. I don't know.
A lot of newspapers did, and maybe still do, publish pollen indexes in the newspapers too.
So pollen has gotten a bad rap.
Pollen has gotten a bad rap. And that's also one of the things that we focus on as we go through life. Pollen gives us hay fever, so that's what pollen is for, to give us hay fever. But another question they ask is, what is the purpose of a flower?
Yes, and surprisingly, something like 30 or 40% of people thought it was to be attractive and beautiful. And if you look at the history of botany, you find that this was a view of flowers that was held back in ancient Rome and ancient Greece, that flowers existed to please humans by being beautiful.
And that's a pretty good reason, I suppose, because that's what we all love about flowers. We look around and we see them, and they're beautiful, and they make us feel good. But is that the purpose of them?
Well, not to appeal to our aesthetic sense, but rather to appeal to the aesthetics sense of insects, because the showy parts of flowers, the petals, have evolved through natural selection, we now know, starting with Charles Darwin, that flowers evolved to attract insect pollinators.
And that's a sexual function and not necessarily an aesthetic function. Food Chain Radio program. Today we're talking with Dr. Lincoln Taze, who is a professor emeritus of plant physiology at the University of California, also UC research associate Lee Taze. Together they met in a laboratory, I bet, somewhere, and you were talking about plants, and all of a sudden it was true love, and now it's Mr. and Mrs. Taze, co-authors of a book, Flora Unveiled. And that's what we're talking about today. It's a book about the sexual reproduction of plants, but it's also the story of why we have had such a tough time coming to grips with thinking of plants as sexual beings that they are. That's the story. Do stay tuned. Right back.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land, we can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Mike Lolson here. And today we're talking with
Jason,
the co-authors of Flora Unveiled, The Discovery and Denial of Sex and Plants. Had a little technical difficulty, but that's life, right? We have technical difficulties along the way. With us today, UC Professor Emeritus of Biology, Lincoln Taze, and UC Biology Research Assistant, Lee Taze. And the subject today is plant sex, but not really. It's really about how we have had trouble throughout the history of the human race coming to grips with the fact that plants indeed have sex. And let's go back like 14,000 years ago, we started to breed plants, or we started to grow plants, and we started to breed animals. And so we could figure out the sexual reproduction of animals, but we never did come to grips with the sexual reproduction of plants. What happened?
Right. Well, what was striking to us once we looked at the whole history of human civilization in relation to understanding the sexual cycle of plants was that when domestication of plants and animals began, and the first to be domesticated was probably the dog, which was domesticated from wolves around 12,000 years ago.
We just had a wonderful story about that on the food chain.
Yes, yes. That's a fascinating story in itself. Now, what is characteristic of animal domestication is that it's mainly involves breeding. So you start out with an animal that has the desired traits. But then in order to enhance that further, you breed the animals. Now, when plants first began to be domesticated about 10,000 years ago, they didn't know that you could breed plants. So there were no such things as prehistoric plant breeders. All they could do was to select the plants using just artificial selection that had the traits that they wanted, such as large fruits or seeds, and then continue to grow those. There was no way to breed them. So sex was not as obvious, because plants are quite different from animals. Animals are are mammals. They're very much like ourselves, so they have the same kind of reproductive cycles as we do. But plants, the reproductive cycle is so different that it was not immediately apparent.
Is it really different, or is it just different shapes?
And no, it is very different. And in fact, this is something that people don't understand. In fact, we don't even address just how different they are until the very end of the book, because for a long time, the question was whether plants had sex. And the answer is yes, they do. But it took so long to even reach that point that it was only in the 19th century that people realized that that's not the end of the story, that there's something even more strange that comes after that. But going back to sex and plants, we began to think, well, why is it that people have trouble understanding this concept? And one of the reasons is that plants have, throughout prehistory and history, have always been identified with women, with femaleness. There's an intuitive idea that comes from just watching a fruit grow. What is a fruit? A fruit has seeds in it. It contains the next generation.
And it swells up.
And it swells up just like a pregnant female. And so the association between fruits and femaleness was intuitively, must have been intuitively obvious to the earliest humans.
And also there must have been a cultural thing there as well.
Very.
Whereas men were out hunting and slaying critters, and women were gathering.
Exactly. So women who traditionally have had to care for their children couldn't afford to go traipsing around following herds, hunting. So the men would go out hunting, and the women were predominant, would stay near the settlements or near where they were living, do a certain amount of hunting of small animals and fish, but they would also be in charge of foraging for plant foods and fibers as well. And of course, plant food processing was their job, and also textiles, weaving plant fibers into cloth was the woman's job.
We know that happened very early. Recently, some scientists, some archaeologists have discovered that in the very earliest Venus figures, the small amount of clothing that those figures are wearing were woven from plant products.
And somebody had to do the weaving, and it sure wasn't going to be the guys, right, Lee?
Probably not.
Probably not. So there's a gender bias built into this.
Yes, that was sort of the beginning of a gender bias that has lasted until this very day. The next stage in human social development was the invention of agriculture. And here again, there is a distinction because agriculture began as horticulture, and hoe agriculture, sometimes call it. And this was done primarily by women as well. That's true of many, even contemporary, non-industrial societies. Women take a primary role in agriculture. So women probably invented agriculture to begin with.
And because they were the ones messing around
with
plants.
They were the ones, were the expert, they were the botanists back then.
And they probably liked the idea of hanging around in one place instead of moving all the time.
Exactly, yes, that's right. The men would still follow the
the critters about.
Herd, yeah, and of course they would tended to be the shepherds who would take care of the herds.
So then the question is, we have this gender bias with respect to how we see plants, but how did that lock our minds into the fact that plants couldn't have sex? Because people had sex, we all knew about that, and But how did...
Well,
how did
plants were thought
to... Just a second.
To,
we're going to have to take a quick break.
Okay.
That's what you call a tease, right?
Right.
Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. We're talking about plant sex. Do you think plants enjoy sex? Well, that's really not the subject, but it's a fun question to think about. And that's what we're doing, is we're thinking about how we think about plant sex. Right back. Well, folks, it's easy to see and imagine that plants are associated with the feminine, because that's what plant we see. When we see a plant, we see a fruiting tree, we see the seeds swell up and blossom into an apple or what have you, and carry the seed on. So we associate throughout history plants with the feminine. And that has a way of permeating how we think. And you use an excellent example, Doctor, about colors. And pink being for girls, is that the way it is? Or blue for boys, right? I have to keep these things straight. But it wasn't always that way, was it?
That's right. Really, the baby boomer generation was the first generation to grow up thinking that pink was feminine and blue was masculine. At first, children were all dressed in white before they had the blue-pink color coding. And little boys, in fact, were dressed sometimes in dresses.
You know, that's right. When you look at the period photographs,
it had curls and things like that. No one worried about it because Freud hadn't really taken hold yet. People weren't worried about the psychological effects of anything on children. So then gradually the idea arose that, maybe it wasn't good for boys to be dressed up in dresses, and maybe they needed to have their masculinity reinforced. So they began to color code girls and boys and dress them somewhat differently. And interestingly enough, the first code they came up with was pink for boys and blue for girls.
Because, of course, pink was a derivative of red.
Red.
Red meant fire and heat.
Fire and heat and aggressiveness. And blue was thought to be cool and calm and serene, which the way... And so here we need to make a distinction between sex and gender. Sex is a biological term referring to male or female reproductive ability, whereas gender is a cultural term, and it's all of the characteristics that one associates through our cultural society with male or female.
And then, of course, this whole cultural overlay has a way of fixing and locking in how we think about things.
Absolutely. So we have the phrase, seeing is believing, but we also, the converse is also true in many cases, where believing is seeing. If you believe something strongly enough, you're very likely to see it, whether it's UFOs, Elvis, or Bigfoot, or you name it.
Mm-hmm. And so if you can convince somebody to believe something, they'll see it.
Yes, and I should say that everybody is susceptible to this sort of self-deception. Even scientists often are unable to see data staring them in the face, because it's outside their frame of reference. They haven't thought of the correct paradigm yet to allow them to see what the data is telling them.
Yeah, and for example, a scientist gets sometimes has a great notion and then goes into the lab looking to prove that notion, and that has a way of coloring or creating the bias.
Yes, if you start out with a bias, then your data will tend to confirm your bias.
So there's all kinds of reasons for locking our thinking process into one thing. What the heck did we think plants did for all those 14,000 years?
Well, that's a good question. If a plant that is reproduces without sex, that's basically an asexual type of reproduction. And in plants, it's called parthenogenesis. Now, parthenogenesis literally means virgin birth. And since in the case of the plant, the pistil is, there's the stamens and the pistils give rise to the fruit. If the pistil forms a fruit directly without any sexual interactions, then that is called parthenogenesis. And so the Greeks, for example, Aristotle believed that plants produced fruit and seed by a process of parthenogenesis.
Okay, so they saw the pistil and they thought, well, it's on the... There it is. It's all there. It's all self-contained.
It's self-contained.
So they just take care of themselves and that's that. And they didn't see the fact that bees were flying around or butterflies or any of the other pollinators that didn't fix that.
Yeah. Now, one other cultural influence, very strong cultural influence we haven't discussed yet, is how this gender bias of sex, of femaleness and plants became absorbed and assimilated into religion.
Of course.
And of course, exactly. So if one looks at ancient agricultural societies like ancient Babylonia, Sumer, Assyria, back in the Bronze Age, the deities in charge of agriculture, such as Inanna or Isis or the Greeks Demeter, these are mostly women.
Right.
So nearly all of the agricultural deities of the ancient world were female. And this adds to this growing perception that plants are essentially parthenogenic females.
Mm-hmm. And so you have, gosh, millennia worth of bias holding forth that plants don't have sex. How did we turn that around? How did we come to our senses?
Well,
did we overcome all of those biases that we had developed?
Well, it didn't happen all at once. There was a major breakthrough, in a sense, in ancient Babylonia because date palm trees was very important to the economy of the ancient world. And date palms are dioecious, which means that they exist as separate male and female individuals, just like people are dioecious in that sense. And there are many dioecious species, but the date palm was so important that it was inescapable that they would discover that, gee, this one tree, a date palm tree, produces fruit and the other one doesn't. So one is barren and one is fertile. And it didn't take long before they associated the fertile tree with the female and the barren tree with the male. And they also realized, so at first they thought, well, why do we need this sterile barren tree? Why don't we just sort of
chop those down? Yeah.
We'll just have an entire orchard of female trees, and then we'll have double our productivity. Well, you can guess what happened. The fruit didn't grow.
Well, ironically enough, that very story is perfect for taking us to the next segment, which is, do plants enjoy sex? And we bring up the story of Sinsemilla marijuana to talk about it. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about our perceptions of plants and plant sex. Do you think plants enjoy sex? Is that possible? Ooh, if they do, what does that mean? Do stay tuned. Right back. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with co-authors of Flora Unveiled, The Discovery and Denial of Sex in Plants. UC Professor Emeritus of Biology Lincoln Tays and UCSC Biology Research Associate Lee Tays. And we're talking about our perceptions of plant sex and how we just didn't get it for like 14,000 years. But some of us must have. And let's go back way back in time to what, Sumeria and the date palm?
Sumeria and Babylonia and the date palm.
Sure. And there were male date palms and female
exactly.
date palms.
And so this was a puzzle at first, and they tried growing the female trees without the male trees, and of course that didn't work because no fruit was produced. So then they developed the idea that, so then they realized that they could artificially pollinate the female trees. So they would grow a few trees off to the side of the orchard, collect all the pollen, and then sprinkle it by hand onto the female flower, and voila, they got fruit. So they actually discovered artificial pollination back in something like 4,000 years ago.
Okay, so then we figured it out, but we didn't.
Well, we didn't, because they never generalized it to other plants. They thought, aha, the date palm is a sacred tree. It was associated with the goddess Inanna, and it was not considered to be an ordinary garden variety flowering plant. This was a sacred tree, and they thought it was quite different. The only other tree that had properties that anyway resembled it was the fig tree, and the fig tree was pollinated by wasps, and they knew that you had to have the capra fig, which, or goat fig as they call it, which was the functional male tree of the fig tree, in order to pollinate the edible fig, which was a female tree. And they knew that wasps were involved somehow, but they didn't understand it. They knew it was similar to the date palm, but yet different because an insect was involved, whereas date palms are wind-pollinated, as are, you know, many other plants are wind-pollinated too. So the date palm and the fig tree were considered the exceptions, and it was never generalized. And then for hundreds of years after that, the idea of sex in plants in general was completely dropped. And then some even began to doubt the ancient stories about the date palm.
And it just went right back to where we started from then.
Exactly. And it was, as I was saying earlier, the early ideas of plants being associated with deities, mm-hmm. agricultural deities, when Christianity came along during the Middle Ages, Mary initially was assimilated many of the characteristics of the earlier agricultural goddesses. She was considered a goddess of plants, goddess of wheat and growing and mm-hmm. Abundance and agricultural productivity. And more, every time you see, say, a picture of the Annunciation, you see what? You see a lily. A potted lily, and the lily is like the rose. They're strongly associated with Mary, and they are symbols of purity and virgin birth.
And there it is. How did we come to grips with our naivete? Well, we weren't naive. We knew. We absolutely knew beyond the shadow of a doubt that plants don't have sex. How was that?
Well, it's interesting. With the discovery of the microscope in the 17th century.
Oh, it was Lee that did it. An electron microscope back in 17th century.
One of her ancestors, I'm uh-huh. sure. The microscope led to a detailed investigation, first of human reproductive systems, and the people discovered the uterus and, you know, all of the details of the reproductive systems of male and female. And they began to look at plants, too. They began to, and the first to do this was Malpighi, who was a medical doctor, as all botanists were back in those days.
Because that's where the medicine came from.
And Malpighi looked at the flower, and he said, the flower is a plant uterus. So,
ooh.
Again, he is saying the plant is basically a female structure. And he said, how does the plant flower produce a seed? It menstruates. Pollen is the menstruation of a flower. And he said, this purifies the sap and refines it so that it is now able to produce a seed. And so it, the first scientific approach to sexuality in plants was still a one-sex model. That is, the flower is female. But it now had become clinical. It was now the flower was no longer just a beautiful object. It was a uterus.
So now we've taken it out and put it into the realm of Li, where we start really looking at these parts in detail in microscopes. And we're seeing things that, well, we have to answer. We're finding ourselves asking questions that we have to answer.
Right. And the next microscopist was a British microscopist, Nehemiah Grew. And he decided that, well, if the uterus is present in the plants, why not the male reproductive structure?
And that's what we're going to find when we get back from our last break. What happened to the male structure? Where is it? Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson. Oh, my goodness. We're talking about plant sex. For 14,000 years, we did not believe plants had sex. And then somebody came to the realization that they do. And they had to show everybody else. And what happened when they did? Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, we finally figured out that plants have male parts. Must have been a great discovery, Dr. Li.
Yes, that it was. Although Malpighi, who was the more the older senior scientist back then, his uterine theory was so dominant that Nehemiah Grew, the British microscopist, who had the idea that, well, maybe the stamen is a male structure. But he was afraid to say that because of Malpighi's influence in the Royal Society. And so he came up with a compromise. And this shows that diplomacy is not always the best strategy in science. You should go for truth, not diplomacy.
Half truth and
so,
half, yeah.
So
okay.
what grew... how he solved the problem of not offending Malpighi was to say that Malpighi was correct. The stamen is first in a part of the uterus that is involved in menstruation. Later, it turns into a penis. And that's when it releases the pollen, which he equated with sperm.
Wow.
So this was a compromise solution that was very confusing to people, but it was the first glimmer of the theory that the flower actually contains both sexes.
Li, you talked about what happened when science started to come to grips with reality and present it to the general public. What did happen?
Well, after Linnaeus, who began to... he's actually the father of modern classification. He based his classification of plants on the sexual elements within flowers, how many stamens, how many pistils they had. And he wrote about the nuptials of plants and the marriage beds and the joys of plant sex, essentially. And this caught on throughout the world, especially in England. And it was, but botany became very popular with women. And the general public became scandalized and began to discourage women from studying botany. And many body ballads were written about what the carryings on within these multiple marriage beds, multiple husbands, multiple wives, and flowers. Especially Darwin's grandfather wrote a wonderful poem about the loves of plants, which absolutely scandalized the entire British nation. Even people like Rousseau got involved in it. Women continued to be interested in plant classification and in botany, but they began to bolderize, and also women botanists began to bolderize their work and leave out the whole idea of sex in plants in attempting to describe botany for women and children in order not to offend our sensibilities. So it became quite a scandal.
So here we have a scandal now interfering with scientific research. I mean, then it becomes a cultural thing where you're ordered not to see things the way they are.
Yes, and it also, in England especially, it got mixed up with political fears about the French Revolution. Mary Wollstonecraft, for example, was accused not only of encouraging anarchy, but also encouraging women to be unfeminine.
Okay, now, we have just a few seconds left. You're a professor of plant physiology. Do plants enjoy sex?
Well, I think everyone should reach their own conclusions about that.
Lee, what do you think?
I think that people enjoy plant sex because they are so beautiful.
Folks, this has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.